You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Fair.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, an expert on internet harassment joins the show for a look at coordinated online trolling and threats and efforts to turn the tide.
First, on Tuesday afternoon, Governor Scott Walker delivered his 7th State of the State address. One of the biggest headlines that came out of the speech was his proposal to cut tuition for all UW system students.
College affordability was also a major issue at our listening sessions. But it wasn't just students who raised it as a concern, as they're concerned about the cost of higher education. It was parents, grandparents, educators, and many others. That's why I'm pleased to announce that our 2017 through 2019 state budget will do more than just freeze tuition. We will actually cut tuition for all Wisconsin undergraduates throughout the UW system.
Robert Menser joins us now to talk about this and other top news stories from the past week. He's a storytelling editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So, Rob, the governor's proposal that we just heard there to cut tuition for the UW system students, that seemed to come as a surprise. Was anybody expecting this?
Walker had sort of hinted about it, but I mean, yeah, that's a piece of news out of the State of the State. You will notice that the speech did not specify an amount, did not also specify what that has to do with what the state budget is going to do to overall funding of the system. So a lot that we do not know, but I mean, it's a signal as the state heads into the budget process. And after the speech, Walker's spokesman told journalists that that the tuition cut would be paid for by additional state funding, but that still, you know, has to sort of fit into a whole structure. The UW has asked for $42.5 million more in the next budget, and they also asked for an increase in tuition. So there's a lot that we don't know about how this proposal will fit into, like, sort of larger operational plans for the UW system.
And what have UW system administrators have to say about this news?
Well, so people just really talk past each other on this issue, I think. So from the point of view of Governor Scott Walker or of Republican legislators, this is really seen as it's a focus on like a consumer fee. So cutting tuition or before this freezing tuition is almost like a type of tax cut for middle or upper middle class families that are paying tuition to UW. For somebody who's within the UW system, this is also the way Democrats tend to speak. They look at what the system needs itself in order to operate, to be effective for the state. And that's just not the way that Republicans talk about it.
Now, you mentioned that the UW system is asking for something like $42.5 million in funding in an increase. And Governor Walker said that the cut that he's proposing would be offset by more funding. But that's not to say that the UW is going to get that $42.5 million, is it?
It's not. It's not to say that at all. And this set that against they asked for $42.5 million plus a modest but still a rise in tuition. So the system absorbed $250 million in cuts in just the last budget. And as they will point out, or other advocates will point out, the sort of overall share of state funds to the UW system has eroded over a much longer period of time than that. So, I think it's certainly there will be some parents happy to see the bill go down, but I think it's very, very unknown what it looks like on these campuses.
We're getting caught up on state news from the past week with Rob Menser, storytelling editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. And Rob, on Wednesday, 5 former Department of Natural Resources secretaries wrote a letter calling on Governor Walker and the legislature to reject a proposal that would split the DNR into potentially 5 agencies. First of all, tell us more about what we understand about this proposal to split the DNR.
So this is kind of a sort of a hobby horse of a state legislator in Balsam Lake, which is in the rural sort of northwest part of the state. And yeah, I mean, it would break up the department into a potentially a bunch of agencies, and also it would reassign some of what the DNR does now to other agencies. So it's very complicated, but basically the sort of the thrust of it is two main agencies, which would be one that oversees hunting and fishing and sort of outdoor recreation stuff, and then a separate agency to do the environmental protection and the pollution control stuff.
And so what did these secretaries say about why they're not on board with this?
Yeah, so they don't like it, and the reason that a lot of people have objected to it is that it is basically just the idea that a split up agency would have less ability to do, you know, to sort of do environmental enforcement or to handle those pollution regulations and so on. It's a smaller agency. It would have less clout. It would be easier to sideline. This is the theory. And that was in this letter from the former administrators, but they also took a little bit of a different tack. They pointed out that a new department would also have to hire new administrators, and you would have to pay those people salaries. There would be a director and a deputy director and an assistant to the deputy director, whatever. So they argued that it would end up costing the state more money, and it would end up adding to the size of state government, which seem like arguments that are, you know, aimed at persuading Republicans.
Interesting to look back. It sounds like the consolidated DNR that we have now was initially a bipartisan effort when it first began.
It was. In the 1960s, the DNR was created, and in fact, this letter came from bipartisan appointees under Democratic and Republican governors. And you know, I think it's important to say that this is like far from imminent, this proposal. For example, Governor Scott Walker did not talk about it in his State of the State address. There was no sort of signal that he's laying the groundwork to do this. But it is something that there's some Republican legislators who support it. So, you know, they could end up working on it this year or in coming years. And so this is, these guys were trying to shape the way that debate would happen.
And Robert, finally, another story from your neck of the woods. An adopted 10-year-old girl in Wausau met her twin sister for the first time this week on Good Morning America. Can you tell us about that one?
See, this is nice. You see, Veronica, there are still nice stories.
It is nice.
Yeah, so Audrey Deering is 10 years old. She was adopted when she was a baby girl from China by a family who lives here in Wausau. And as a Christmas present to her, her mother hired a researcher to find out more about where she came from. And essentially what they came back with was the news that Audrey is a twin. And not only that, they were able to track down her twin sister, whose name is Gracie Rainsbury, and she lives with a family in Washington State. So at the time that we wrote about this in December, Audrey and Gracie had become kind of long-distance friends, and they would video chat and that sort of thing, but they had not actually met, and they were planning to do a family trip in the spring where they would finally get to meet each other. But in all the publicity that happened after the story ran, Good Morning America got in touch, and this week on Wednesday, they actually met on live TV, and they cried, and everybody cried, and it was quite a thing.
Yeah, we actually have a little bit of that meeting. Here it is.
I finally have a I felt like there was somebody missing, so it was like, now it's complete.
Now it's complete is what Audrey has to say. So a bit of a tearjerker there. Any word on what's going to happen next? Will they get to see each other more often?
Well, they got to. I think that they had a pretty memorable week and got to hang out in Manhattan and explore Times Square together and everything like that. And yeah, I think that the families seem to get along. They plan to get together again, and I think it's lovely.
Great way to go out, Rob. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That was Robert Menser, storytelling editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin, and he joins us every Friday for our state news roundup. Online harassment has become a fact of life for many people in the age of the internet. While it may have started as a series of isolated incidents, the Gamergate controversy ushered in an era of coordinated, sustained attacks.
And that spread beyond the world of computer games into the worlds of pop culture, sports, politics, and elsewhere. Ghostbusters star Leslie Jones was the target of a widespread campaign of racist and sexist messages, including the hacking of her personal website. Olympic athlete Gabby Douglas reported widespread abuse on social media, and Jewish journalists were the targets of Holocaust-themed harassment during the presidential campaign.
But there's also been pushback. A Breitbart editor was banned from Twitter for allegedly coordinating the attacks on Leslie Jones. Gabby Douglas co-founded an anti-abuse organization called Hack Harassment, and the Anti-Defamation League has kicked off an effort called Innovate Against Hate to cut down on abuse.
Danielle Citrin joins us now. She's a professor at the University of Maryland School of Law and author of Hate Crimes in Cyberspace. Danielle, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back on.
So sports, pop culture, politics, how much has online harassment spread over the last couple of years?
Well, you know, it's a pervasive problem, but I'm not entirely sure it's grown astronomically, but we are paying more attention to it. Seeing celebrities experience it, whether it's Leslie Jones or Jennifer Lawrence and the spread of her nude photos, I think we're finally paying attention to the problem. And the presidential election, I think, put into, you know, acute light the attacks on journalists, and the kind of silencing that they experience, many leaving Twitter as a result of the abuse. So not sure it's grown. It's a significant problem in the hundreds of thousands of people who experience it every year.
Are women and minority groups the main targets of the worst forms of online harassment?
Yes. So the majority of victims of cyber harassment are female and also people of color and sexual minorities. And the abuse is often sort of sexually humiliating and sexually threatening. So it's, you know, threats, rape threats. It's lies, but sort of the suggestion someone has a sexually transmitted disease and privacy invasions that often involve the posting of nude photos. And, you know, men experience it too, and it often will follow the same playbook. Men are kind of reduced to being gay and then demeaned on that basis and then, said, well, you're going to face anal rape. So it often is like very much the same playbook, but women and minorities are often the subject, more often the subject.
And you mentioned the silencing of people who might try one option to withdraw from social media, the online world. Is that often the goal, silencing voices in these online harassment campaigns?
You know, so often it seems to be, right, that the point is to make people withdraw, to lose their jobs, to be really terrorized. And it works. So a recent report by Data and Society found that like 20% of victims withdrew from the internet. They just figured it wasn't worth it. It's working. Trolls, they succeed in their efforts. And that is a real loss to society.
And a lot of times one response to people suffering from this is for people to tell them, yeah, we'll just get off social media. It's no big deal. But in our modern working world, for a lot of people in a lot of lines of work, that's not really a viable option, is it?
Right. I mean, so to say to a journalist, just, you know, shut off Twitter. You know, so often law enforcement will say to people, just, you know, shut down those profiles. What do you need to be on Twitter? What do you need to be on Facebook? Or why do you need to have a blog? It's crucial. There's so many careers where having a social media presence is indispensable to getting a job, keeping a job, and getting the word out there. So it's almost like saying to a journalist, like, you don't have to have a Twitter account, like you don't have to work. And we know that most employers use, you know, Google and other search engines to check up on an interviewee. And so often the case, if they don't find anything, that also raises a red flag if someone retreats. And if they find negative information, then they're unlikely to get the job or the interview.
Now, when we're talking about something as bad as threats of violence of some sort, you said we're paying more attention to these problems. Are law enforcement officials starting to take this more seriously?
You know, I think there's some good news, right? when I first started working on these issues in 2007, both, you know, state, local, and federal law enforcement, the response was like, oh, believe me, we have bigger problems. You just turn off your computer. But I think we're seeing states and localities pay more attention, especially when you have leadership, like we saw the Attorney General of California, who's now U.S. Senator Kamala Harris. When she was in office for 2 years, she spent incredible energy educating law enforcement, creating resources for victims, teaching peace officers about crimes that exist on the books in California that can be brought to bear against harassers and stalkers. So, you know, I think, you know, California isn't the only state increasingly paying attention. We're seeing it. It's a slow process, though. I don't want to overstate matters. There's a lot of education that needs to happen, both on the technology and then also on the law for law enforcement.
Talking to Danielle Citrin, author of Hate Crimes in Cyberspace, looking at coordinated online harassment campaigns against celebrities, everyday people, journalists, and efforts to push back. And let's get into that now, Danielle. It seems like we mentioned a couple of groups that have recently formed to try to turn the tide on online harassment. Are we seeing more pushback efforts like that?
We are. So, you know, I love the new entrance to this space, you know, hack harassment, especially when you have a high-profile person who's behind it, who can garner public support. There are groups like the Cyber Civil Rights Initiative and Without My Consent who've been working with victims but also with lawmakers across the country to criminalize non-consensual pornography, you know, the posting of nude imagery without someone's consent and in violation of their privacy. And there's been incredible success. So Cyber Civil Rights Initiative worked with lawmakers in 34 states and that now have laws on the books that criminalize the posting of nude photos in violation of someone's sexual privacy. So we've been seeing real results, too. What I think we need to see now is, of course, the enforcement of these laws and teaching law enforcement. But that will happen in time, hopefully. So groups have had a big impact, I think, on the way we understand this problem.
This is often seen as a problem between online harassers and their direct victim. In schools, it seems like a lot of anti-bullying efforts focus on the bystanders, what people, third parties can do to intervene and shut down a situation. Is there something like that when it comes to online harassment?
You know, there is some potential, certainly, for bystander support, especially when you're a moderator of a blog or a moderator, let's say, of a subreddit. When you see abuse happening, you can step in, shut it down. If you have control over the content, stop it. But sometimes the problem is when people step in to defend victims, they become victims themselves. So it is a dangerous proposition when you put your neck out to protect someone. There certainly is the risk that the cyber mob identifies you as next. So I've seen both. You know, in my book, I talk about scenarios where, you know, people just trying to stand up for others online and protect them ended up provoking the mob to set upon them. So I think we should consider all ways in which we can combat this problem. And sometimes being a bystander is really effective if you're a moderator of a blog or a group online. And if you can shut it down or create speed bumps to this kind of abuse. But it's not without risk and worth thinking about.
And how about providers of various services, the Twitters and Reddits, Facebooks of the world? What role do they play?
So, I mean, I think what's energizing and hopeful is that really powerful platforms like Twitter and Facebook, YouTube and others have been engaged in the last couple of years of fighting back against abuse. You know, Twitter in the last 2 years has now banned threats, harassment, stalking, and hateful conduct and has hired many more reviewers, has clarified their terms of use, and have made real efforts. They recognize that, you know, their platform has been used for really hateful and destructive ends, and they want to do better. You know, so we've seen the CEO come forward and say, we've screwed up, we want to do better. So I think they've played a role, what we might say, they're as good Samaritans to address really destructive uses of their platform without squelching expression overly. It's a fine line for them, right? It's hard to scale, but at least we're seeing some efforts by some of these important main intermediaries.
Piece of news or two lately. The journalist Kurt Eichenwald had been critical in his writing of Donald Trump a lot. He'd been harassed online. He has some form of epilepsy, and I understand somebody had tweeted a flashing image that actually was intended and did, I guess, trigger an epileptic fit. That's really pushing the envelope of harassment, and that's an attack of sorts.
That's right. I would consider it a form of assault or virtual assault. And this wasn't certainly the first time we've seen this. There was the epilepsy support group has a website. And a number of years ago, trolls attacked the website and embedded code that would cause flashing lights for some epileptics like Mr. Eichenwald. It causes attacks. And so that is absolutely assault. And ought to be understood as criminal behavior. So it's distressing, and hackers know what they're doing, right? There are individuals who are bent on really destructive ends. And I think in the case of the journalist, it seems very clearly designed to not only hurt him physically, but also to shove him offline and silence him.
So a bad story to end on there, but do you see, as we wrap up just briefly, are you seeing steps toward positive changes?
Yeah, I wish I had like the happy story that you had in your last segment. But I think there is good that we're seeing here. More and more victims are coming forward. They're going to law enforcement rather than like hiding in the shadows. I think increasingly law enforcement is taking this seriously. Lawmakers, state and federal lawmakers, recognize online abuse and stalking as a real problem. And I think the more and more we talk about it, and as journalists talk about it as a social problem, I think we're going to see improvement.
Danielle, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Danielle Citrin, professor at the University of Maryland School of Law. She's the author of Hate Crimes in Cyberspace. She joined us to bring us up to date with the latest on online harassment. It's been a busy political week as the 115th session of Congress was sworn in only 10 days ago. Lawmakers have been working at a breakneck speed as they transition from one presidential administration to another.
In the past week, the Senate has been holding a lot of confirmation hearings for nominees of President-elect Trump's cabinet, leading to some tense moments between the nominees and lawmakers.
House and Senate Republicans have been making moves to repeal the Affordable Care Act.
And ahead of the inauguration, President-elect Trump gave his first news conference. It came a day after BuzzFeed released documents of explosive and unverified information about Trump and Russia.
Alana Shore joins us now. She's a congressional reporter for Politico. Alana, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with some of the most breaking news. There's a lot to choose from, but this afternoon, the House passed a bill that helps lay the groundwork for the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. The Senate had done this early morning Thursday, as I understand it. What had to change here to pave the way toward a repeal?
Well, this is actually a budget blueprint that sets the stage for repeal. It's a little complex, but I'll try to break it down for your listeners really easily.
And for me.
They want to avoid a Senate filibuster, and this is the only way to do it. It's a very arcane process called reconciliation. So they passed this first bill, and that means that when they can actually sort of craft their full Obamacare repeal bill, it only needs 51 votes. Without this process to begin with, they'd be subject to a filibuster and would have to get 60, which would be difficult to impossible.
And as I understand it, reconciliation only works for certain kinds of stuff related to the budget. So it's possible that what the Senate and House did there doesn't necessarily apply to everything they're going to want to do.
It's likely that they'll be able to repeal most of Obamacare. Mm-hmm. What they probably won't be able to do, depending on how they craft this package very carefully, is quote-unquote replace or rather create a system for those folks whose health insurance might be at risk to preserve their care.
So this is a first step toward repeal and replace, and it happened pretty fast, but it seems like there's still some debate even among Republicans over how fast the actual repeal and replace will happen, and if they're going to happen at the same time.
Sure. I mean, same time as you and I might think of it in reality, probably impossible. But within, you know, days or weeks is certainly the goal. That's certainly what President-elect Trump has said he wants.
Well, Paul Ryan argued on the House floor earlier today, calling for the ACA to be replaced. Here's a listen.
Everyone in America should have access to affordable health care, including people with pre-existing conditions. This is what we want to achieve, but that's not what's happening under Obamacare. The law is collapsing. The insurers are pulling out. People can't afford it. The deductibles are so high, it doesn't even feel like you got insurance in the first place. This is a rescue mission. This is a necessary move, and I urge all of our colleagues to do what is right, because the time is urgent. And on top of this, to my colleagues, we need to keep our promise that we made to the American people, and this helps us do just that. I yield back.
So Speaker Ryan arguing there that the law has failed massively from his perspective. Democrats are still debating that point, though.
Certainly. A lot of this, though, is Democrats not really wanting to give Republicans the political rope, so to speak, to try to hang President Obama's signature health care law. Things could change over the next few weeks or months. It's entirely possible that Republicans wait until the summer to really put up a replace or repair or really whatever you want to call their new plan. At that point, you might see some moderate Democrats wanting to get on board.
Right. Joe Manchin from West Virginia has signaled that, he doesn't want to repeal Obamacare, but he's willing to work with Republicans to fix, replace, come up with something better. Is he alone among key Democrats so far?
I think he's probably the most open among moderate Democrats about his willingness on that front, but he's certainly not the only one. I mean, the fact is that 10 Senate Democrats will be defending seats in 2018 in states won by Donald Trump. And if they have to kind of sit down and work with the president-elect on, even if it's a couple of patchwork fixes, something they can call, you know, Trump care and have it be more or less Obamacare, these Democrats might be willing to do that.
Talking to Alana Shore from Politico about a busy week in national politics. The Affordable Care Act, Alana, not the only thing on the table. Senate confirmation hearings for a bunch of President-elect Trump's cabinet nominees. What's your takeaway, big picture, before we look at specific ones? What did you take away from the hearings we've seen so far?
Well, certainly Rex Tillerson did not have a great hearing, but it's important to recall that Democrats changed the rules for these nominations in 2013, and as a result, won't really be able to filibuster them. So I think you can expect to see nominations, potentially including Tillerson, get dragged out. But as far as successfully defeated, that will be very difficult to impossible.
Well, Florida Senator Marco Rubio, Republican, former presidential candidate, has been one of the biggest critics, it seems like, of Rex Tillerson. He's somebody who could stand in the way of the confirmation and even in a committee. Here's a back and forth between Senator Rubio and Rex Tillerson this week, talking about Russia.
I understand there is a body of record in the public domain. I'm sure there's a body of record in the classified domain. And I think in order to deal with a serious question like this,
Mr. Tillerson, what's happening in Aleppo is in the public domain. The videos and the pictures are there.
Fully informed before advising the president.
Well, I encourage you. There is so much information out there about what's happened in Aleppo, leaving the Chechen issue aside. What happened there is clearly documented as well. There's so much information out there. It should not be hard to say that Vladimir Putin's military has conducted war crimes in Aleppo, because it is never acceptable, you would agree, for a military to specifically target civilians, which is what's happened there through the Russian military. And, I find it discouraging, your inability to cite that, which I think is globally accepted.
So tough words there. Within the Republican Party, in effect, is there a thought, Alana, that Republicans like Marco Rubio, maybe others like John McCain, who are at odds with Donald Trump over Russia, might scuttle this nomination?
There's certainly a chance, and absolutely Marco Rubio has yet to say how he will vote. So it's important to recall that Senator Rubio supported John Kerry. So he has, a record of sort of wanting to give presidents their national security team. Now, it may very well be that behind closed doors, Tillerson can't satisfy these concerns. My money continues to be on him getting confirmed. I think we'll see a lot of tension, a lot of suspense. We might see one or two Republicans defect, but keep in mind they can lose three because we will likely see a Joe Manchin vote for Tillerson and potentially some more moderate Democrats voting for him.
And then Jeff Sessions, well, Senator Sessions may or may not be voting on other nominations. That still seems like it's up in the air, but he's up for a nomination of his own as Attorney General. A couple days of testimony there. What do you make so far of what you've seen between senators and their colleague looking to be Attorney General?
Well, it's going to be a pretty partisan vote, but again, Senator Sessions can be confirmed as Attorney General with only GOP votes. Mm-hmm. Right now, he does have Senator Manchin. He'll probably pick up a couple more Democrats. The big question was whether what he had to say on DOJ policy would be enough to win over a few more Democrats. And the answer appears to be no. You know, I think you saw that telegraphed when Senator Cory Booker became the first sitting senator to testify against another senator in this context.
Before we go maybe to some other nominations, the other big news of the week, this press conference, President-elect Trump, his first one as president-elect, got testy at times between Trump and reporters. And that Russia issue came up with the BuzzFeed publication, these unverified documents. Trump asked about his relationship with Russia and Putin. Here's a listen to some of what Donald Trump had to say about Vladimir Putin.
If Putin likes Donald Trump, guess what, folks? That's called an asset, not a liability. Now, I don't know that I'm going to get along with Vladimir Putin. I hope I do, but there's a good chance I won't. And if I don't, do you honestly believe that Hillary would be tougher on Putin than me? Does anybody in this room really believe that? Give me a break.
So a call back to the campaign against Hillary Clinton there. But Russia is a topic that keeps dominating this transition period. Is this something you think Donald Trump and his campaign want to be talking about now as we get closer to inauguration, Alana?
I think it's an enduring mystery how Donald Trump and his campaign, well, transition, we should say, really feel about Russia relations. We learned just today that Michael Flynn, the president-elect's national security advisor, was in contact with the Russian ambassador to discuss potentially joining talks about a peace in Syria. Now, as your listeners heard earlier in the Rex Tillerson recording, Republicans like Senator Rubio agree with Democrats that Russia is involved in some pretty bad atrocities being committed by the Syrian government by virtue of their support for the Syrian government. So right now, it's perhaps the biggest mystery in Washington whether we will see a complete 180-degree shift or close to it on Russia after the president-elect takes the oath of office.
We're talking about politics and Congress with Alana Shore. She's the congressional reporter for Politico.
And we'd like to hear from you. What do you think of Congress working to repeal the Affordable Care Act? What's your takeaway from the president-elect's press conference? Are you hoping all of the president's nominees get confirmed, or would you like the Senate to reject one or more of them? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation about Congress, the Senate confirmation hearings, the president-elect's press conference, and other news out of Washington. Alana Shore is with us now. She's the congressional reporter for Politico.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think Congress should work on? They've made dismantling the Affordable Care Act a top priority, already taken some action laying the groundwork for how they would repeal that. What do you think of President-elect Trump's cabinet nominees? Some tough questions in the Senate. And what about the president-elect's first press conference as president-elect? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Alana, let's talk about that press conference. Very testy between the president-elect and some of the press there. Unusual situation, unusual setting at the Trump building with some Trump employees there clapping along to some of what the president-elect had to see. What do you make of media-president relations as we saw there?
The Trump campaign has made clear that it has no qualms about being pretty vocally and perhaps bitterly critical of news outlets like CNN, whose reporting it disapproved of. Your listeners may recall that Jim Acosta of CNN was very harshly spoken to as fake news, and his network was the one that reported the intelligence briefing that took place last week in which Donald Trump was told of potential compromising information that may have been gathered by Russian folks. So tense is probably the word I would use.
Let's go to our callers. We've got Amy on the line in Eagle. Amy, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Amy?
My concern has been for several years that the Republicans have refused to make any attempt to fix the existing Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, that they say they agree with major proponent, major parts of that plan, ensuring people with pre-existing conditions, letting young people up to the age of 26 stay on their parents' plan, et cetera. But they insist on repealing the whole thing. I have skimmed Paul Ryan's Better Way health plan online, and literally a fourth to a third of that document is bashing President Obama and bashing Obamacare, as opposed to offering specific steps to replace it or fix it. And it occurs to me that they don't necessarily want to fix what's there. This is almost a vengeance or a revenge thing against President Obama to disappear his name off of this health care plan, off of the whole concept of ensuring that every American have access to Affordable Care Act.
Amy, thanks a lot for calling in at 800-642-1234. And Alana, Amy's onto something here in the sense that the Affordable Care Act ended up being like the defining issue of President Obama and of his opponents in a lot of ways. This has this powerful symbolic value politically, doesn't it?
Well, absolutely. There's a reason we call it Obamacare. I think beyond, however, the president's legacy, the notion that the government should be involved in setting the framework for individuals to receive health care is just really anathema ideologically to many, if not all, conservatives. So that's also an aspect of this that needs to be recognized. Mm-hmm. It's not just about hurting President Obama. That's certainly a goal.
Thanks for the call, Amy. And so as we look for the replace part of repeal and replace, do you think Republicans are going to make a pretty concerted effort to have less of a defining role for the government, for the federal government in particular, in health care?
Well, certainly that should be expected, but they're also in a big bind because the president-elect has said that things like, you know, making sure that children up to age 26 can be on their parents' health care, and barring discrimination for pre-existing conditions, these popular elements of this very government-focused program, President-elect Trump has said he wants to keep those around. So I believe the term that Senator Schumer used this week is box canyon, and that kind of is the political challenge facing Republicans. They keep getting hemmed in on exactly what this replace is going to look like.
We're talking to Alana Shore from Politico, looking at a busy week in national political news, efforts to repeal, to start repealing anyway, the Affordable Care Act, confirmation hearings, and more. You can join in with your thoughts on those issues at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Alana, a theme in the last couple of weeks has been criticism from President-elect Trump of the American intelligence community related to their statements over Russian hacking, and now President-elect Trump saying that they had leaked some or all of these unverified documents. The intelligence community saying, no, we did not do that. What do you make of this conflict just a week from inauguration between the president-elect and the intelligence community he's going to be relying on?
Even as we speak, the Intelligence Committee in the Senate is defining the scope of its inquiry. And I think it's going to be an extremely closely watched process for a committee that's not used to operating in the public eye. Because remember, Senator McCain, Senator Graham, and most Democrats want to see an independent select committee examine this issue along the lines of what we saw after 9/11, something that would be separate from Congress. And Republican leaders are not interested in that. So right now you have, again, this very narrow committee process with committees that are used to operating mostly in closed session because they deal with very classified information. And I think the pressure for more transparency will be huge.
Let's bring on another caller now. Terry is with us in Colfax. Terry, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I do not see Paul Ryan remaining Speaker of the House the next 4 years under President-elect Trump. I just feel that there's a moral compass there that Paul will have to probably be true to himself and be on the way on the campaign trail. Paul Ryan very much had to be very careful of what he said. And I just don't believe behind closed doors those two are going to get along.
Terry, thanks for that call. People are watching, Alana, for signs of tension there. There are, as Terry mentioned, ideological differences from what we hear from Paul Ryan and Donald Trump, differences in approach and temperament, too, I think it's fair to say. Is this going to be a story we're watching over the next couple of years?
Absolutely. They're two of the most powerful men in the world at this point, given that Speaker Ryan is still third in line for the presidency. So, yes, that's guaranteed.
Terry, thanks for the call. Lois joins us next in Madison. Lois, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up, Lois?
Just one comment that about Trump's attitude toward this recent released supposed leak of news that when Conway brought out an unverified intelligence report on Hillary, he was all for it. And when one comes out on him, he attacks the press about it. And that's all I pretty much want to. Just a comparison, I guess.
Lois, thanks for the call. That'd be FBI Director Comey. And that was, it is a bit different in the sense, a lot of that was coming from an intelligence official as opposed to this dossier of unverified, largely unsourced information. Do you see a distinction there?
Yes, absolutely. It's important to know that the dossier that was put on the internet, again, has not been corroborated, and it's not even clear that the allegations in that document were the same ones that the president-elect was briefed on. A lot of confusion has been created.
Lois, thanks a lot for that call. So, Alana, we're starting to wrap up now. Inauguration just a week away, as I said earlier. What stories are you, as a reporter, going to be interested in following, going to be focusing on? Though, of course, there will be surprises along the way, I'm sure.
Well, I mean, certainly Russia sanctions is a big deal. You know, we have talked about the Russia intelligence issue with regards to Mr. Trump. But Mr. Trump will also have to decide whether to keep in place the sanctions that President Obama set up on two separate occasions, even before the hacking efforts in the election came to be, at which point there was a third round. So it's really unclear whether either of those three rounds of sanctions will survive. I think you'll see a lot of the same Democrats who are pushing for more information about Russia's election activities, pushing for those sanctions today.
We'll leave it there for now. Alana, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Alana Shore. She's a congressional reporter for Politico. She joined us to recap the week in congressional and political news. Still time for you to share your thoughts over on the Central Time Facebook page.